Ah, can you smell it? It's the scent of baseball. Yes! Opening season the other day. A lot of great, I don't know, camaraderie, excitement in the air. UConn women winning their fourth championship in a row. Unbelievable! Imagine being on a basketball team as a freshman. You win a championship. As a sophomore, as a junior, as a senior. Unbelievable. Huge respect going out to the ladies of UConn. Unbelievable. If I was on a men's team, I'd be freaking out, being like, oh my God. If we win one championship in 4 years, we'll be lucky. We're going to talk about a lot of great things today. Of course, baseball in the air, but there's no chewing tobacco in the fields, in the dugouts, at local stadiums, says New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. I guess he's going Bloomberg on us. But, you know, I understand that. It's been coming for a long time. Going to be talking to Tony Fletcher. Tony Fletcher is with Cycle for Sight from the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. It's a great organization, and during this upcoming event is amazing because it gives people who are blind and visually impaired the experience of riding a bicycle, a tandem bicycle. And that's called a stoker in the back. When you're in the back of a tandem bicycle, it's called a stoker. When you're in the front, it's called a pilot. And they get to experience something like they would normally not be able to. So pretty incredible stuff. We're going to speak to Tony later in the show. We're talking about the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention overnight walk, which is happening in New York City in June, which I'll be doing, which I'm going to urge you to join me with. And I'm also going to be introducing a very, very important person in my life later in the show who has won the recipient of an award named in her honor. So I'm not a huge American Idol fan. We've talked about this in the past couple weeks about one of the guests, or exactly one of the candidates who was trying out. He didn't make it, etc. But you know what? I guess I'm getting nostalgic, possibly. I am capable of being nostalgic. But because it's ending, you know, and more importantly, I was thinking about watching this show last night. Now it's down to two finalists. Okay, Dalton was kicked off last night, voted off. Now, there's a few points I'd like to make because Dalton, I have a great deal of respect for because he publicly admitted he's bipolar. So big time hats off to Dalton for many reasons. Number one, for having the chops to make it this far in a competition. He's got some background, which I'll tell you about, in terms of being a pretty seasoned musician thus far. But to be on a public platform like that, American Idol, let's try it again, where millions and millions of people are watching. It takes a lot of courage to say, I'm bipolar. It's who I am. I didn't choose to be. I can deal with it. And music makes me the happiest. So I really, really respect from someone who is able to do that because I just think it's incredible. Now, he was actually kind of a big deal before Idol. He was a member of a boy band, IM5, which is founded by American Idol creator Simon Fuller. You probably heard this possibly. Also Madonna's creative director, Jamie King. And who else was a part of that? Perez Hilton. That's right. Perez Hilton, that gossip columnist. Anyway, so he's got a good track record. And, you know, I'm sure he's going to do well. But I was actually voting for him in terms of I actually didn't vote. I've never voted for anybody in American Idol. But in my head, I'm like, he is probably going to be one of the final two. So my point is the fact that anybody who is bold enough to have a disability, mental illness, and vocalizes, be public about it, it does a lot to change stereotypes. And I think that is fantastic. Another point I want to mention is that one of the finalists is a very, very talented, extremely gifted African-American woman. I don't remember her name off the top of my head. I didn't have enough coffee yet today, even though it's 11 o'clock in the morning. And I think she's going to walk away with it because she's like a modern day Aretha Franklin. Very likable, very cute. I mean, you just want to hug her. A single mother, I believe. I'm not sure if she's married, but from what I've seen, it looks like she's a single mother. And what makes me think, would a woman like this have an opportunity to make it in the music business? I mean, we all know how cutthroat and how competitive it is, even just an American Idol, to get to the final 30, 15, you know, you're going through oodles of auditions and cuts. So Think about the Jennifer Hudsons in a world. There are so many out there, possibilities for people like that. That will there be another platform such as American Idol? Yes, people say, I remember when American Idol started, a lot of the music industry pros were like, you know, this is BS because this is a shortcut to getting in the industry because you should have to pay your dues. Well, it is kind of a major, major crash course of paying your dues when you go on AI because of the intense schedule for the weeks and months leading up to it. So, you know, watching it last night, I kept thinking about, you know, again, I'm not a huge fan of it because it became more and more commercialized, et cetera, and they had to keep changing the product and adding more ingredients, bells and whistles, and making it more Grammy-like, et cetera. And I get all that because it works, and there's two elements to it. There's like a competition to it, and then there's the telecast part of it where, you know, they're musicians and they have to perform well. So obviously they have to package this probably more 30-70 in the telecast performance because obviously, you know, ratings are everything in the world of television. So it's kind of, I guess, you know, I think about the people who possibly may not have a chance. A woman, a single mother possibly, even if she is married, can she go out and, you know, work the circuit, you know, get her music heard, cut demos, etc.? Jennifer Hudson, would she have been able to do that? I think Jennifer Hudson actually tried out like two times prior to actually making it through. So it's kind of interesting. You know, I wish all these people the best, you know, the two finalists and it's no guarantee when you do win that you're going to have a clear pass. Certainly we've seen some Kelly Clarkson. Obviously, she was the first and, you know, she's had her ups and downs, but has done extremely well. And but I think it is a great platform for people who would ordinarily not be able to really challenge and chase their dream. So who knows? You know, maybe another show will be created like this. Maybe it will be on Hulu. Maybe it will be on Netflix. You never know. I mean, with the non-traditional platform of media today, with producing programs and shows and events, you know, who knows what's down the pipeline? Fox may be able to, you know, launch something sooner or somebody else. You know, it's pretty cool, right? So, of course, you know, the other day, Sunday, the music started. The stadium doors open. The people started flooding in. Ah, smell of hot dogs, popcorn. Yeah, opening day, baby. And no tobacco, says New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Does this impact your life? My life? Not at all. Well, I guess if you're really kind of grossed out by people really, you know, producing a lot of Lugers from the big wads of tobacco. It looks like they have a sock in the side of their mouth, right? So, I mean, that's going to be, you know, an end to it because, you know, it's long been said it's not healthy. We all know this because tobacco in any form, it's dangerous. Smokeless tobacco was linked to serious negative health, including cancer, cardiovascular disease, and gum disease, and it's just downright terrible for you. But of course, it's been part of the sport since time and tradition. It's a habit. Baseball is a sport based on habitual maneuvers, you know, stepping in the batter's box, you know, rolling up your sleeves, touching your helmet, pulling out the front of your shirt, hitting the baseball bat to your cleats left and right, stepping out of the box, doing that. As a matter of fact, I think they're either enacted new rules or maybe they did this in the minor leagues in terms of how long you can step out of the box. Anyway, losing my point here. So it's pretty cool, though, because so in all three stadiums around here, actually both stadiums, Citi Field and Yankee Stadium, smokeless tobacco has been banned. They can't chew tobacco. The law is effective immediately. So as of Sunday, makes smokeless tobacco illegal at all sports arenas and recreational venues that issue tickets. So the reality is if you're a player, professional player, you can't chew. Fans, you know, it doesn't say anything about fans, but hopefully if you are chewing, you're not putting a wad down by people's feet. It's going in a cup. And, you know, it's going to be something obviously the players have to adjust to, and I'm sure, again, they knew this was coming for such a long time. So the sunflower seeds the stock industry may be excelling. And it's a good thing long term because obviously it's been linked to. As a matter of fact, I have a friend of mine who chews, and it is just a foul, foul habit. I don't know how his wife deals with it. I don't know how he could possibly kiss somebody. Anyway, I digress. I don't plan on kissing any baseball players in the near future, but ironically, actually, this is actually kind of a small number. I thought it would have been more. 30% of Major League Baseball players use chew, which has already been banned in Boston, San Francisco, and L.A., so actually we're kind of behind the curve a little bit. And you know what's interesting? And you think about this. So how could we, the most astonishing point of this whole blurb I'm talking to you about, is how could we appoint a mayor who is a fan of the Boston Red Sox? Right, Jason Taubenfeld? Right, Jesse? I mean, how could this mayor sit in his chair, New York City mayor, and be a fan? He shouldn't have vocalized it. His popularity would have probably gone up, that's for sure. Unbelievable. Well, that's not the only thing people are talking about around the area here. Because, you know, Ted Cruz a few months ago had some disparaging remarks, as you recall, about New York. And didn't go over well at all. Actually pissed Donald Trump off. And this is probably the one time I was really behind Donald Trump. So Cruz was scheduled to speak at a Bronx Lighthouse College Preparatory Academy yesterday until students wrote a letter to the principal asking her not to let Cruz come, prompting staffers to cancel the appearance. Now, I think this is really, really cool on a few levels because, number one, I applaud students for, one, having an opinion, right? I mean, they're high school kids. There's a lot of things going on in their lives. You know, to have them to be astute enough to know what is happening in a political world is great. I love that. And hopefully that's a thing of social media that is bringing more current events to the surface that would interest them. I'm also proud of them for, you know, of course, not even having an opinion, but articulating their thoughts and kind of, and standing up for what they believe in. It's one thing if they say, all right, you know what, Principal X, we're not happy about Ted Cruz coming to our school. We know the primary in New York is a week away. This is all just, you know, a show, dog and pony show. He doesn't mean what he says, et cetera, et cetera. And that's one thing. But they took it a step further. They said they're going to plan a walkout. They will walk off the campus if Ted Cruz walks on the campus. These are high school students. These are not college students. I think that is extremely, extremely respectable. I won't say it's bold. I'll say it's progressive. And how can you begrudge them? How can you fault them? You know, this is a democracy we live in. And, you know, preparatory school, these kids are smart. They're astute. Their parents probably were aware, certainly, of this proposition, and they maybe talked it over with their parents. If not, even more impressive that they have it within their own persona to realize that, you know, this isn't cool. We didn't like his remarks about New York, and we know he's coming here just to try to get more delegates, yada, yada, yada. And that's the deal. I take my hat off for that because I just am very, very impressed all the time when I go to high schools to speak about, you know, the topics I cover: overcoming adversity, anti-bullying, drugs and alcohol, mental health, celebrating differences, resiliency, by the questions that I receive and field from a lot of these very, very astute high school students, from freshmen to seniors, and their experience, their candor is amazing. And sometimes, you know, it varies. Sometimes, you know, kids are in their shell and they're embarrassed and don't want to ask a question that they feel will be embarrassed by. But overall, I don't know whether it's the age of the internet, social media, that's making them a lot more vocal. And I think a little bit more confident in being outspoken. There's got to be some research on that. And I'm going to look into that because I really think that's a fascinating point, especially as a parent. I want to know what the outcome is this, possibly is. And so from the How Cool Is This file, I mentioned this at the head of the show, UConn women team beating Syracuse to take the NCAA championship for the fourth time in 4 years. That's incredible. Oh, man. Gino Auremma, I mean, fantastic coaching. I mean, it's all about drive and dedication, sacrifice, and, you know, I mean, the WNBA must have a direct line into his office saying, hey, listen, we got our eyes set on player X, Y, and Z here. I mean, for the first women's D1 team to ever do this is incredible. Senior veterans, I mean, imagine this, posing with a trophy for 4 years in a row. That's pretty incredible. It's never been done before, and, you know, it's a tall order to replicate something like that. You know, I mean, how often can you say something? I mean, he's very well respected. How often can you say something about this, about coaches today that have taken such a different direction? And his coaching mantra on and off the court is highly respected. And obviously his formula of success has been proven over and over, four times in a row and more. But in terms of the NCAA championship consecutively, the wins four times in a row is amazing. I think it's pretty, pretty incredible. So not too long from now, April 4th, there is a walk in New York City. It's called the Out of the Darkness Overnight Walk to Prevent Suicide Prevention. It's happening 16 miles, dusk till dawn. And it's a really, really interesting event. I took part of the first walk. That was in 2002, the inaugural walk in Washington, D.C. It was actually a 26-mile walk. It turned out to be like a 28, 29-mile walk because I was up in the front of the group and they had the signs posted in the wrong direction, so we ended up walking even further. But it was one of the most moving events I ever took part in. And I also want to I mention this because I'm bringing on a very, very special person to talk about something that happened to them almost 25 years ago that changed her life forever and also changed my life forever. This person is extremely important to me, extremely well-loved and respected by many, many people in New Jersey, Connecticut, across the country. And I wouldn't be surprised if internationally as well, because her name has been spoken in many, many circles. She actually won the inaugural Peggy Farrell Suicide Award the other day in New Jersey. And I was happy to say that a lot of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention executives and leaders from afar came to celebrate this incredible day where she has dedicated incredible amounts of time and compassion and love for people that need it most in her lives. And this person I'm introducing to you is, first name is Peggy and her last name is Farrell, but I call her Mom. Hello there, Mom.
Hi, good morning.
Is it weird to be heard like this?
It certainly is very weird. I'm sitting here thinking, what am I going to say?
You never have a shortage of words, my dear.
That's true. Probably not.
No. So, I mean, 25 years ago, none of us would have thought that we would have been catapulted into this arena, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, but we were. We found out about a meeting in Rutgers, New Jersey, a support group that you and one of my siblings went to, your daughter, Mary, my sister, and it turned our lives around. And that was the absolute beginning for you, correct?
Yes, it was. We found a way to survive through support groups. That was our first experience, yes.
And when did you feel that, I'm sorry to cut you off, when did you feel that this is going to be something that was going to be part of your life?
Oh, I don't think I did at the beginning. I felt that I was going there just to help myself and maybe help my family. I never dreamed that I would become an important part of my life and trying to help other people. But it has been very, very helpful to me as well.
Well, it's fascinating because, you know, you mentioned a very interesting point that, of course, we went there to help ourselves because we didn't know what to do. As a nurse yourself for, you know, many, many years, 20, 30 years, you're not prepared for something like this. I wasn't. We knew our brother, your son, you know, was going through clinical depression. We thought he was, you know, coming out the other side, very, very healthy, and we were actually very optimistic about it. But it didn't have this outcome that we certainly were hoping for. But, you know, we found this organization that helped us cope and actually made us feel like, wow, this is not something that we have to be ashamed of, not something that we, you know, have to live with in silence. And we can find people, and I used to go to sibling groups, and, you know, you break out into different divisions of the loved one you lost, and you would go into the division of losing a child. And it was extremely, extremely helpful at that time. And then it wasn't that long after that you actually, you know, were facilitating groups, and you facilitate two groups monthly. And how did that actually launch?
Well, I started going to the group, and I thought, how am I ever going to sit here and talk about such things? But you sit there, and you listen to everybody talking, and you realize that you can talk about it. And the most important part about it, you know, that suicide shouldn't be a secret. We should be able to talk about it and find a way, maybe through a support group, to get better.
So obviously you found it cathartic for yourself.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did. And that was not long after Michael had died, and I guess I thought that that was the only place I could really talk about it, which for a long time it's been that way. The support groups do something for you that you can't do with family and friends sometimes, because you just don't know how to talk about it, but because there's all the things like the stigma of it, the religious part of it, other than family and friends, sometimes you don't even want to talk about it to anybody else. It takes a while, but going to a support group has been very helpful.
And I also experienced facilitating groups as well, and I found that I got satisfaction, which you, I'm sure, have trumped me by years and years and many experiences, by just actually probing. And, you know, by all means, there's no initials after my name or yours. Actually, no, I'm sorry, you're a nurse, so you do have initials after yours. I misspoke there. But asking the right questions, even if you're not facilitating in a group, because you know where someone was in a dark time, and you feel that it kind of sparked an idea or maybe gave them a different perspective, it actually makes you feel good as well.
Oh, I think so. I think helping other people has been the most effective thing that I could have done for myself, because I think I've tried to encourage people that they can talk about it, that suicide, it shouldn't be a secret, and hopefully we're getting there. But I have many people that come to our groups, and they'll say, and you know what? Nobody knows that my husband killed himself, or nobody knows my daughter or son. And we have to get people to understand that there's no shame, no stigma to it, because it's caused by an illness.
Or if you feel like there is, then who cares? You know, you have to do what makes you feel good. And being honest about what happened to your loved one is probably going to make you feel good.
Right, right. Because you learn that grief never really goes away. You experience a suicide, you face sometimes silence, and you don't want to talk about it. But then once you start going to group, you know that there is a reason that you can be there and help other people. That's been the most important thing I can do. I still have many, many people come to group and say, you know what, nobody knows about this. And we know that get a support group will help you, because you can talk about things that you can't talk, and you can listen to what other people and say to yourself, wow, I thought the same thing.
Mm.
So it's been very helpful.
Now, what I found very, very fascinating, the more years that go by, because you started something extremely grassroots. You started going to people's homes. You would get phone calls or emails, actually, probably even before email certainly existed, which is kind of amazing and a testament to how long you've been involved with AFSP in terms of being incredibly giving, that you would actually go to people's homes and find out, you'd be asked to, or you'd reach out to them, you know, so-and-so lost their son or their husband or wife or whatever the case may be, and you would actually go to their house. And I remember hearing about this, and it would bring it back to me, bring me back to, you know, the time when Mike took his life, and I always said to myself in the back of my mind, that's got to be so, so hard for you. So what gave you the courage and drive to do something like that?
Well, I think I got the courage to start by going to the support group. And a very good friend of mine, Karen Maxim, who was at the time was at UMD, University of Medicine and Dentistry at Rutgers, and she talked about it, and she convinced me that it was good to do. Sometimes the best thing to do is to visit families at their home, because they don't want to come to a group. They don't feel comfortable talking about it in front of strangers. when you go to their house, it's there. And all, the strange part about it sometimes is sometimes there'll be a person sitting in the kitchen, maybe a parent, another child, and they don't want them to come in and listen. So we've got a lot of work to do trying to encourage people to be comfortable talking about it. That's for sure.
Comfort level-wise, was it immediately comfortable for you, or was it awkward and very surreal for you as well because it kind of maybe brought you back to a very raw time in our lives?
Well, it always does bring you back because, first of all, they usually ask you why you were there and did you ever lose someone. And there's a comfort level that you reach after a while because you tell them all the things that they're thinking. I should have, I could have, what should I have done different? And I think sometimes when they hear you saying those words, they think, oh, my God, I'm not crazy. This is what everybody thinks, or hopefully.
Exactly. You know. I mean, that's what actually helped myself and Mary, I believe, my sister, your daughter, going to support groups. The thoughts that you would have, you hear other people articulate them. Or now another thought is that, your son, my brother, leapt off a 40-story building, and that's a violent way to die, certainly. But you hear other stories that were even more violent, and I would almost say in my mind, I would never articulate this like, oh, my God, there's someone else who's worse off than we are.
Yeah.
Strange, right. But, I mean, that was the reality of it. And whatever it does, whatever you have to do to kind of make yourself feel good and talk yourself into making, positive steps or feeling that you're not, like, in complete isolation. And getting back to your crisis intervention, this is something you did in a grassroots level, and then American Foundation for Suicide Prevention actually made this an official program due to your steadfast work.
Yes, I did. Well, because I think by going to these families and stuff, you learned about the commonality of the experience, and you learned that you can help them, and you can help people face the fact that they don't have to have silence. And I think that then we started to have annual meetings at different colleges, and we enrolled students. In fact, I had a graduate student from Rutgers call me yesterday who would like to come to one of our groups. It's kind of hard to have outsiders come because sometimes the families there are still embarrassed, but I tell them that they can come if they understand that it should be they should not be able to talk about it but in terms of names and so forth. So we've learned that there is no shame and there is no stigma, but going to the groups helps people considerably.
And that's a closed door kind of platform, and going to a wide open, very public venue are your fundraiser walks that you started in New Brunswick, New Jersey, in Buccleuch Park. Over 10 years, it's raised hundreds of thousands of dollars collectively, and that's something that has done a lot, again, for families because they feel like collectively they can form a team, they can go there and be amongst people who have experienced the same thing.
Well, I think the other thing, I went to a school down in Monmouth County that had many, many suicides, and they asked me it was a high school, they asked me if I would go from room to room to talk to the kids about it. And very surprisingly, many of the kids did not want to talk about it because I guess perhaps because their family said you can't talk about it, and they faced a profound silence. But after we were there all day, I do think we got them to understand the only way to survive it is to talk about it. And this is what they talk about, the feelings they have, and somebody will say, oh, I felt the same way. Mm. It's very, very helpful.
I've heard through the different people I've spoken to by speaking at schools that there's talk of implementing a different program, almost like a health class, about mental illness, which I think is invaluable.
Well, that's the point, because people think suicide is caused by a mental illness, which is a condition of disease. And that helps people to understand that, because in order to survive, you have to be able to talk about it. And then there's the moral issue that some people talk about because of their church. So there's a lot of things that we try to help them get through. Going to the homes is very helpful, except interesting enough, sometimes there's a couple of people that are in the house and they won't even come talk to us. But hopefully we're going to get more that way. The support groups are really a wonderful way to go through it and talk about it.
Peggy Farrell is my guest. She's the chair of the North Jersey Division of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. She won an award the other day, which we'll get to in a moment. I want to point out to our listeners, Mom, is that the word survivor, for people who are not familiar with the field of suicide, et cetera, people can easily misunderstand the word survivor. It's almost like, oh, did you take your life and fail at it? Survivors are the people who are left behind, who have lost loved ones to suicide.
That's true, and that's a good point you make up, because a lot, you're right, people do think, why is that name like that? Mm. But I guess maybe I might have thought that at the beginning, because
sure,
it's such a hard thing to go through. But going to the support groups, going to schools, going to people's homes, all of those things are very, very helpful, and we've made some great progress, I do think.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, one of them being National Survivor Day, which happens every year the week before Thanksgiving, I believe, which mm-hmm. is a national, like its name, event where you expedite one particular location in Brookdale College in Lincroft, New Jersey, where it's localized and also national, where people can hear spoken word from doctors, et cetera. But it's also a day of coming together and understanding people's experiences. And I believe they have breakout groups as well.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And that's very good. But I think the most important thing is that suicides can find comfort in talking to other people mm-hmm. when they've suffered the loss, because they can't find somebody outside of their own inner circle that they should be able to talk with. And we try to get them to understand suicide is caused by a disease, and it shouldn't be a secret. That's one of the headlines that AFSP does have now. One of their taglines says, suicide shouldn't be a secret. We're making a lot of progress, I think.
And I believe the AFSP has a very, very realistic and daunting goal at the same time, to reduce suicide by 20% by 2020, is that correct?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's a great goal.
Well, they have, the AFSP precisely has some strategies. They're funding research. They're doing many, many educational programs. They're promoting, this is an important one, mm-hmm. legislation that would impact suicide prevention and possibly increase funding to help it. And it also helps to provide programs and resources for survivors, for educators. We do a lot of work with schools. And, of course, essentially the most important thing are the support groups, which do help people. Because we want, again, I hate to repeat myself, but suicide shouldn't be a secret. And more we can talk to people, get them to come, it's going to be helpful.
So when you got the phone call that you were going to be the recipient of the inaugural Peggy Farrell Survivor Award, what was your first thought?
Well, I'll tell you that I didn't realize that's what it was. They said that normally it was going to be our regular annual, or not a monthly meeting, and they said, well, we're going to have this and this and this, and we're going to have an award for you. But it was very simply said.
Sure, they didn't want to.
I had no idea that it was establishing the Peggy Farrell Award, which is quite an honor, that to say the least.
Sure, we didn't want to get you too nervous with all the pomp and circumstance, but we were all whispering behind your back, yes, okay,
right,
who can
right,
make it?
Right, right.
But it was a great honor, of course. It's certainly that you deserve for all your tireless work, Mom. I mean, you spearheaded so many different programs, and all the phone calls and emails and hand-holding, I'm sure tissue supplying that you supplied in the last 24 years is, you know, unfathomable, and your tireless effort should be recognized by many people.
Well, I do, and as I say, I think the most important thing, I am concerned about education and increasing legislative. We go to Washington once a year and try to meet with a lot of legislators, and the interesting part about that is every year when we go, there's very few that will actually speak to us. They send their assistants. I understand they're busy, but I think little by little we are making some inroads, and we leave them a lot of information to talk about suicide and to try to get more policies enacted to help people that need the money and so forth.
Well, obviously this award doesn't mean that you're done. Listen to what you're saying. You're far from done. You're a force to be reckoned with. Obviously, there's a lot more work, as you alluded to, of Congress. Oh, my Lord, that's a whole nother interview alone. because there's, you know, obviously stalled programs, but, you know, with certain people that are movers and shakers, there's a gentleman that's actually situated in Washington, D.C., who represents AFSP, whose specific job, John Madigan, I believe is his name, whose sole responsibility is to lobby for change, correct?
Yes.
Fantastic. Yes, so where's that award hanging? Is it up in your...
No, it's still on the table in a box.
In a box. That's how humble you are. Take that thing out, shine it up, and be proud of it.
Well, I am proud of it, that's for sure. It was really quite an honor to be there and have all those friends and family be there with me. I guess that sometimes you think it's good that you were able to move forward and do some of these things. And I am glad about that because I do think that little by little, we're trying to help all these families. And the most, right now, most important thing can be the legislation. We need to get Congress to understand what it's all about and try to work with us more.
On behalf of AFSP and our family, my sisters, Mary, Ann, and Nancy, and everyone else in the extended family, congratulations, Mom.
Well, thank you.
You've done a great job. You've turned something very, very negative into a positive, and your son, my brother Mike, would be extremely proud, and we wish we didn't have to actually be in this movement, but again, we are, and we are making a difference. So,
well, there was one woman I met, and this is the one thing I need. Iris Bolton, who is a therapist in Georgia, but also lost her son, she writes, "I don't know why, I'll never know why, I don't have to know why, but I can move forward and help other people."
Well said. We're going to let you go because I'm sure you have emails and phone calls to return.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Mom. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care now. This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks so much to my mom for coming on the show. I think she did great. I guess the apple didn't fall too far, huh? We like to talk, both of us. So we're switching gears here. We're talking from going from depression and mental illness to cycling because why? That's a natural segue. As a cyclist, I've been a cyclist all my life because, number one, being visually impaired, I wasn't able to get my driver's license. So when people turned 16, 17, got their driving permits and their license, I was still on the bikes. Matter of fact, I picked up a few dates on my bike and they thought it was so romantic. And we'd ride down the street for the first mile or two. And they're like, "Oh, my God, this is so romantic. I think you're the best, Mark. You're the best, best, best." And like a mile later, they'd be like, "I can't feel my butt." And then they'd want to get off. And then I wouldn't see him again. Anyway, I had the pleasure a few years ago to interview a lot of Paralympians. And a lot of them were cyclists, one particular sport, in terms of there's track cycling, road cycling, et cetera. And there were a lot of cyclists who were blind or visually impaired. And they were in a tandem cycle in the back. And that position is called the stoker. They were actually doing the pedaling. And I found it fascinating, the fact that they were able to do something that they were ever sometimes maybe never able to do because they were born with blindness or they lost their sight later in life. And this is something that they returned to a sport. So Cycle for Sight is an incredible, incredible event that's happening Saturday, April 16th, part of San Francisco's Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. And it also benefits the Enchanted Hills Camp. And joining me right now is the director of Enchanted Hills Camp. What a great name is Tony Fletcher. Tony, how are you, my friend?
Mark, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Are you
a little foggy out here, but we're ready for a big ride on April 16th.
Oh,
sure.
Well, so am I. So am I. If my schedule works out, I'm going to jump on a plane and ride out there because any excuse to throw my leg over a bicycle is a great excuse for me, certainly if it benefits children as well. So are you a cyclist?
I am a cyclist. I am a cyclist commuter here in San Francisco.
Oh, great.
For about the last 17 years.
Wow.
I do not own a car, but I should say my wife owns a car, so when in doubt, I go to her.
How many gears do you have on your bike?
It's a 21 speed.
21, you need that on the hills, right?
Yeah, I tend to use more of a mountain bike style in the city because of the road conditions, and I ride through the park a lot, but cycling in San Francisco has increased dramatically over those last 17 years, that's for sure. A lot of congestion. Get a little feel like Manhattan around here these days with all the building and everything. But so cycling is definitely the way to go.
Just stay away from messengers, correct?
We still got those guys doing their
thing.
Oh,
my God. Trajectory of crazy. So tell me, do me a favor. Tell me how what an incredible feeling it must be to have someone partake in Cycle for Sight, who's possibly never ridden a bicycle since losing her vision or having major decreased vision, or for the first time riding maybe as a young adult or adult who's never experienced being on the bike and the freedom and the wind blowing back your hair and the sounds and the smells.
Yeah, when I started at Lighthouse over 25 years ago, and one of my first assignments was working with the youth program. And what we find a lot of times is that our kids just don't have the same access to physical education. So it was early on when I got the youth program involved with tandem cycling. And we would do it on a pretty regular basis. And I would say, hands down, the feeling of, it's more of liberation, moving through space at such a rapid speed and breaking a sweat. And, you know, if you partner them up with a good pilot, you know, great conversations, meeting new friends. So you've got the combination of networking, physical exercise, and just a sense of, participating in something that was just thought about maybe on the sidelines. So I find it to be a great experience for all ages in terms of, getting out there and oftentimes we're riding along very scenic places out here. In
Napa Jefferson. Valley? I think that's pretty damn scenic.
Sonoma, incredible cycling community out here. A lot of competitive cyclists are based out of Sonoma and Napa Valley. International.
So I imagine
competitive cyclists are out there. We're not necessarily at that level. Oftentimes we train, between 5 and 15 miles when we're doing cycling. The goal, of course, the longest ride at Cycle for Sight is actually a 50-mile ride. And part of that ride does include climbing Mount Veeder, which is about, we'll call it about a 1,600-1,800 elevation gain.
It's respectable.
Yeah, and they're doing a 50-mile ride. That's, ultimately where we'd like to get cyclists doing it. But 15 miles is the minimum distance, and it's a leisure. It's not a race. It is a ride. And I find that, by the end of the day, the smiles on everyone's face, that they've got something accomplished, it makes it all worth it.
And of course, you have a happy medium distance of 25 miles. And I'm sure it's very likely, Tony Fletcher, that at the end of that day, you're going to get somebody that will come up to you that was on the back of a tandem bike and says, "I'm hooked."
Yeah, that's exactly right. If we can inspire someone to make that part of their routine in their life for exercise, fantastic. And I heard you mention a little bit earlier about the Paralympics, that we do have some cyclists that have been inspired to train, go back to Colorado, and get into a competitive nature of cycling. It is one of the Paralympic sports. And so here at the Lighthouse and through Cycle for Sight, I probably have worked with about a half dozen, I would say, Paralympic quality athletes over the years.
Fantastic. So I imagine that no matter what disability you have, if you find an outlet in life, especially something so freeing as cycling, that it'll have such a major positive aspect, a trickle-down effect on all aspects of life in terms of certainly just making you feel really good and more whole and complete.
Mm-hmm.
Correct? Yeah. I imagine you see this all the time.
I do. I find that with the youngest ones, that oftentimes they're coming with their parents, and I'll find donations of tandems to borrow for the day. Sometimes folks just give us their tandem bikes, and that bonding with the parents, that the parents can do something with their children that is recreational and competitive, and you see that kind of energy take place, that's really positive. But I'd have to say, the last couple of years, I've had a few cyclists that are over the age of 60 that have just started, cycling. They haven't, they had their sight, they lost their sight along the way. Maybe they stayed focused on trying to maintain employment, or they had to go through training, but, they lost that kind of physical. So I've seen it from the young ones that's like, wow, I can do this, to older folks say, wow, I can do this. And then it makes it part of their life. Where I really love it is when we're out there, we're looking for partners, we're looking for pilots, and then the pilot and the stoker, which is a blind cyclist on the back, become friends, They make it part of, you know, who they are throughout the year. Cycle for Sight brings them together and turns them loose. You know, they just go riding, and they don't have to necessarily be organized with Lighthouse for the Blind. They've just developed friendships, and off they go.
Outstanding. And Cycle for the Sight, of course, benefits that camp that you've been in charge of for quite some time, Enchanted Hills Camp. And before we go any further, I'd like to give the website. It's lighthouse-sf.org, lighthouse-sf.org, or you can also click on cycle4sight.com, cycle4sight.com. Now, Enchanted Hills has been around for 60-some-odd years, 63 years, and it's on a 311-acre facility.
Yeah.
I mean, it looks stunning.
Yeah.
I wish I was a kid to experience this all over again.
Yeah, it is. Founded in 1950, and the woman who founded the camp was a New Yorker.
Of course.
Dr. Rose Resnick. She herself was blind. She lost her sight to meningitis at a young age. By the age of 4, she was blind, totally blind. She came out west in the late 30s into the 40s, and she went to come out here. She was a gifted pianist, and she started her career out there. And then she signed up and worked on her master's degree over at UC Berkeley and got her degree, master's in education, and couldn't find a job and couldn't get an interview. I mean, the fact that,
wow,
you know, discrimination at that time, you know, it wasn't even considered discrimination. It was more like, well, you got to be kidding me. So not finding any employment opportunities in the arena of education, she channeled her energy towards organizing youth to do outdoor recreation and camping. And she'd rent some facilities and take groups of kids, usually about 20 to 30. At the same time, because she was a gifted pianist, because she had a vision of wanting to do camping, she started fundraising on the side and got real, real serious about it after World War II. And in 1950, her business partner, Nina Brandt, who had been a nurse in the Army, they started searching for properties, and they found this property up at on Mount Veeder. It was 340 acres at the time. And it had been abandoned. It was a boys' camp, and it had been abandoned for a couple of years. And when she walked on the property, she knew right away that was the camp. In the advertisement for selling the property, they mentioned that the property was located on the enchanted Mount Veeder. So she loved the word enchanted. She said that captured it. She did not like the word mountain because she thought that would scare parents from sending their kids to a mountain, but they will send them to the hills. And so she changed the name to Hills. So it was Enchanted Hills Camp, and that was the birth of it in 1950. And it's grown from, you know, children at that time to now. We utilize camp almost year-round for programming. The summer is still summer programming with family camps, mm-hmm, and youth programs and adult programs and deaf-blind and music academy, horse academy, woodworking, chemistry.
Wow.
We do all these things. But we also do a lot more immersion training. So someone who's new to blindness or visual impairment, and Mark, you know, being visually impaired yourself, I mean, sometimes folks have been living with it for a while, but they haven't dealt with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so we do 1 week immersion training up there, and usually for about a dozen students at a time. And just like we tell people, if you want to learn Spanish, go live in Mexico City. If you want to learn blindness, go live at camp for a week. And you're just surrounded by blind folks and blind teachers, and it you know, helps jumpstart people into learning the skills and techniques that can help them maintain their independence or gain their independence.
It's so.
And we do the same with our summer camp programs. But you know, kids, adults, families—they're coming to play. They're coming to have fun, and that's our number one priority for summer camp programming: is have a good time. And then we'll teach skills and we'll introduce things. You know, we've got young kids coming up to camp. I've had kids who've never peeled a banana before. You know, their mother or their grandmother's always peeled their banana and handed it to them. They didn't know there was a skin
sure
on the outside. To kids who haven't tied their shoe or put their toothpaste on their toothbrush yet.
So it's a great source of independence.
Yeah, we'll find ways for our counselors to teach that stuff. But they're coming to go swimming, to ride horses, to do arts and crafts, to go to the campfires. That's why they're coming.
Hey, that was my MO when I was a kid, Tony. I went to a camp for the blind and visually impaired, and I had the time of my life. At first, I was a little, you know, a little daunting because, you know, if it's the first sleepaway camp for a week, or I forget what it was, 10 days or 2 weeks,
yeah,
and, you know, being around people who are, you know, not like me, but also like me, because obviously different disabilities, but the common core was that we all had some visual disability in terms of acuity, either completely blind or some vision loss.
Yeah.
And we ended up having a blast. As a matter of fact, I actually ended up being one of the people with the more vision on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
And one
mm-hmm.
night I remember, I don't know if I concocted this, but I was one of the ringleaders where we decided in the middle of the night that we should raid the adjacent cabin and have a pillow fight.
Yeah,
so we
yeah.
all, you know, get our pillows and we're running next door and we're all quiet. Shh, shh, shh. And next, you know, I'm like, hold on. I'm looking for the lights. They're like, what do you need the lights for? And I'm like, oh, that's right. You guys don't need the lights. Why do I need to live in a light? And of course, chaos ensued and it was a great night.
That's camp.
Yeah, exactly. That's camp. That's what it should all be about. And the friendships, the camaraderie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I even learned how to play a song. Okay, I'm embarrassed to admit this, but it was Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. But anyway, I learned it in a day. I got up on stage and I performed this song in front of, I don't know, 100 or 200 people with parents. And it gave me great confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. You know what? We put that in. When we're looking at ways for like measurable outcomes, you know, and grantees love to see measurable outcomes.
Mm.
They want to, what are we trying to teach? What are we trying to accomplish? And when I'm working with the staff and I say we're working on leadership or self-esteem, something like performing at a talent show ties directly into that.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, something leading a skit, you know, organizing, getting your other campers, you know, your friends to go out and do a pillow fight is leadership.
It is
leadership, you know, to organize people, say, let's go do this. You know, so there's a lot of ways that we develop what we'd consider, you know, maybe some of the soft skills in employment. But, you know, things that employers are looking for, things that
real-life tangibles. Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, I imagine you've had some campers come full circle and become camp counselors.
Oh yeah, I would. More than half of our staff are blind, visually impaired, and a majority of them have been campers. And through our counselor and training program, we look for some hot shots that, you know, grew up in different states, perhaps even different countries, and so they didn't have a chance to come to the camp mm-hmm. itself as kids, but they'll come out and work as adults. In fact, one of my good friends back there in where are you based, Mark? Where's this show?
New York
from?
City, right in the heart of New York City.
Okay, so one of my good friends up in Long Island, New York, James Hughes. I think he was Teacher of the Year about, you know, half dozen years ago.
Good for him.
State of New York, totally blind. You know, he basically ran in the sighted community his whole life as a kid, and he became a teacher. And you know, he said, "I want to give back to my own community." And so he contacted me, and he flew out. That was in '99, and he's been, you know, off and on as a you know, paid staff or volunteer on his summers, which are very busy. And he has three children of his own. He's coming out to family camp himself this year. So we look for hot shots. You know, anybody who's coming from a different area
mm-hmm.
that has
sure.
the skill set to come out and do it. But we grow our own. We, you know, a lot of our kids want to be counselors as soon as, you know, they're at camp, and we have counselor and training program. And I would say out of the counselor in training, probably only about 10% actually make it onto the paid staff. You know, we hold the bar pretty high, and we train that, you know, if you work at our camp, it's because you can also work at any other camp that you've got that skill set. So we try to keep the bar high for that. And so there's no patronizing or anything like that. But we also know we have to open some doors for people. A majority of our blind, visually impaired staff members, this was their very first paid job ever.
Wow.
You know, and so another cool little thing I wanted to share with you,
mm-hmm.
this might, you know, promote some training like this back east, but, you know, majority of the sighted community have had experience working in fast food or restaurants or, you know, that those entry-level dishwasher jobs and stuff like that, right? We get those jobs pretty early. So one of the things we started about 4 or 5 years ago was we have a kitchen training program at the camp also, where I target blind, visually impaired young folks, usually between 18 and 22, to work in the kitchen and get the training. And, you know, it's a paid position. And we've had some success with some of our folks going out there and getting competitive employment in, you know, at another restaurant or a fast food place, just to get those, you know, those job skills. Because one of the things that I'm finding with a lot of our folks is, you know, just work ethic and stamina. You know,
oh,
if you're in front of a
sure.
computer all day, you know, being on your feet for 6 hours, 8 hours, that can be challenging, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So
for
we're
anyone.
For anyone. So we have a kitchen training program as well as counselor programs, area leaders. If I have someone who wants to go into music for a career, you know, that's one of our area leaders is, you know, the music program area. Or if we have someone who's interested in doing art, or someone who's interested in doing horses, or, you know, so all of my area leaders are blind or visually impaired, you know, coming up for this summer, with the exception of the nature area leader. But out of the seven programs that we have that are area leaders, six of them are blind or visually impaired.
These programs sound amazing, Tony. So they must cost a lot of money. How do you get your funding?
Ooh, well, it's definitely multi-stream funding. The key ones I'll throw out right off the bat is that we do have, you know, bequest or donation mm-hmm. income that comes in, and, you know, people do love the camp and they stay connected and they will make donations or put us in their will or something like that to help us with funding. We have a pretty robust rental market. So I rent the camp out during the school year to other nonprofits, churches, and schools, and that helps us with income there. We do have a fee structure for our summer camp programs. It's sliding scale, I mean, from zero. We ask that the kids pay $60 for, you know, either a week or 10 days, whatever
wow.
the session.
That's quite affordable.
If I get a note that says we can't afford that, we waive that fee.
Sure.
I mean, it's about the kids, right?
Of course.
But we do believe in putting skin in the game. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's trivial, little $60. All the way up to $600 for adults with developmental disabilities and blindness session. But we've had some generous donors that have lowered that. Yeah. Very rarely would someone have to pay that amount.
Or and it's also more care involved for them.
Yeah, exactly. That's the reason. It's a lot more intensive as far as our staffing goes. But we try to keep, you know, a fee structure to our campers themselves, you know, so you don't take it for granted. You know, everybody pitches in.
Absolutely. Well, Tony, if we have any listeners, of course, they could probably log on to the Lighthouse website or cycleforsight.com. That's cycle, the number 4, SIGHT.com. Any listeners who live in the area, San Francisco area, who'd like to volunteer for the event or be part of the Lighthouse in general, or actually help you move. I heard you're having a new facility open soon.
Yes, we are moving at the end of this month, Mark.
That's great. And we're running out of time, but quickly, I heard it's designed by blind architects for blind individuals.
That's it.
I love
right.
it.
Our board president's an architect and world famous, and he had a lot to do with what we're going to be moving into.
Outstanding, Tony. Have a great ride on April. So I just lost my spot. April 16th.
Yeah.
If you want to ride by yourself, if you want to team up with someone and be a pilot, meaning you're sighted and you can ride someone who's blind or visually impaired on the back, there's a role for you.
Yes. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk about what I love.
And thank you for your continued compassion and hard work and just really giving adults and kids some opportunities that they may have never, ever experienced. And that's incredible.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Mark.
Good day to you, Tony.
You too.
This has been Insight on Progressive Radio Network. My name is Mark Farrell. Thanks to Peggy Farrell, the matriarch of the family, Tony Fletcher from the San Francisco Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. Special thanks, of course, to Jesse, producer, Jason Taubenfeld, program director. And if you'd like to listen to the show in its entirety, log on to PRN.FM under Insight page. If you'd like to have me speak to your school, college, or corporation about overcoming adversity, anti-bullying, drugs, and alcohol, and so many more vital topics, check out MarkFarrellMotivation.com. MarkFarrellMotivation.com. Have a rockin' day.